Thanks, Greta. 6 minutes now past 11. Good morning, and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Acton. Glad you could join us. LTV shutdown, talk of a possible Northwest Airlines merger, concern about Minnesota's competitive future, a declaration of war against some legislators, the new chapter in the book, all interesting things that if you had the chance, you might want to discuss with Governor Jesse Ventura. Well, sure enough, you have the chance today. Governor Ventura is back in our studios today to discuss those issues and whatever else you might be interested in. So if you have a question for the governor, give us a call. 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Governor Jesse Ventura, our guest this first hour of Midday. Governor, thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Gary. Enjoy it.
Well, I guess the big news, place to start here, the announcement by LTV that it's shutting down its plant, 1,400 jobs going away, or could go away. In your mind, what can and should the state do about this?
Well, first of all, it's private enterprise. You know, this is a private business, and certainly it's not the state's role to ensure that private businesses succeed. And in the case of the LTV mine, I met yesterday with the leaders of the company, the owners of the company, and the people that operate it up in Duluth. And this is a particularly sad case that the bottom line is the mine has just ceased to produce top quality ore. It's kind of like if you want to put it in the same type of situation as maybe you got a favorite fishing hole and you fish it for 30 years and eventually it is no longer a great place to fish anymore. You're not catching fish anymore there, so you have to move on. And that's the situation here, is that the ore that is coming out of this particular mine is no longer high grade quality, and it would require an investment of the company of anywhere from $700 to $800 million, and you also have technology and modern equipment, and they can't do that type of investment to a mine that is not going to produce top quality ore, which this one won't. And it's a case also, as this is the oldest mine in the state, and the equipment that they have up there is probably the worst of any mine in the state. And so it's sad, but it's strictly economical, where the business has to make a decision, and they've made a decision. Now, what can the state do? Well, naturally, our Minnesota Department of Economic Security is heads up on it. The dislocated worker program will kick in, and we, the state, will do everything we can to ensure job placement for those workers. But there is another positive that the media isn't highlighting either on this, if there is a positive to it. 38% of the workers are eligible for retirement and will be given retirement benefits. So that's 4 out of every 10 workers up there can retire and will get full retirement benefits. They also said that this won't happen, I mean, totally for at least a year. So it's not like it's being chopped off tomorrow and people are going home tomorrow without a job. There will be a year before this will all happen, so people will have the opportunity to go out and try to seek other employment, find other employment, and the company itself is going to make them the highest priority for relocation. But what this will require, naturally, is people leaving the town of Hoyt up there and possibly relocating to Ohio or Michigan or wherever else the company has operational offices going or operational business going. But they are giving them high priority on that aspect too. It's a sad situation, Gary, but unfortunately it's a fact of life, of what you deal with in the private sector economy. You know, businesses are going to flourish for many, many years, and then you know, times are going to be tough on a particular industry, and this can be the result. But the bottom line is, though, is I think they've tapped the mine dry pretty well of top high quality ore, and there's not a lot you can do about that. You can't wish the ore were there. It's either there or it's not there.
Now, you're a pretty persuasive fellow, and a good many of the Iron Rangers have suggested, legislators have suggested, maybe It would be good if you got on the plane, went out to Cleveland, talked to the owners of the company, and see if you could work out some kind of an arrangement, maybe to keep the plant open or find some new buyers for the plant, something like that.
I don't think I met with the owners yesterday. I met with their top people. We're in Duluth. We met in the airport yesterday. And I don't see that as an option, because ultimately it has to be this this particular company has to desire to invest this kind of money. And, you know, they made it very clear that, again, it comes back to the mine itself is not producing the top quality ore. In fact, it was at the bottom of the list for the quality of ore being produced. Mm-hmm. And, you can't, what's the old saying, make silk out of a sow's ear or whatever it is. You can't make the ore better than what it is that comes out of the ground. And so, unfortunately, that's the situation here.
Senator Doug Johnson suggested maybe some kind of a public private partnership to keep the plant open. Is that an area to explore?
Well, it's an area certainly we can explore, but it's not one that, if it's going to be just simply a public-private partnership to keep a sinking ship afloat, I don't think that's necessarily a good idea, too. You have to look at the long range. What are the long range if we go into some type of partnership like this? Is there the ability to be successful in the long term, or does it become just a public subsidy for the next 20 years? Is that what we're looking at here, just subsidizing for 20 years? I don't think that that's necessarily smart policy either.
Yesterday, the China trade bill passed, and there are, again, a good many people who are saying the folks up on the Iron Range, the LTV workers, are victims of similar trade laws, that we can expect a lot more of this.
I don't believe so. I don't buy into that. I think that may be an excuse. Again, it comes back, and I'm repeating myself, Gary, but it comes back to the ore coming out of the mine. Mm. Is it a quality of ore that can be profitable? This company would have to upgrade the equipment, because this is the oldest equipment in any of the mines in Minnesota. To upgrade that equipment would be about a $700 million investment. Are you going to make that investment to a mine that can't produce the high-quality ore? I don't think anybody can sit back and say they would make that type of investment.
Now, I have one other question. I want to get to some listeners here with,
sure,
their questions. There are rumors, or at least speculation, that Northwest Airlines, which, of course, has its headquarters here, big hub, thousands of workers, that they could be targeted for a takeover. What have you heard on that front?
I've heard nothing on that level right now at my office. You know, again, this is a, you know, private business, and you know, many times rumors are done for a reason, you know, for whatever. Generally, when rumors happen of takeover, stocks go up. Things of that nature. So I have heard nothing about it. There's been no contact directly that I've had with Northwest indicating as such. So until that happens, to me, they're just strictly rumors. And I don't, you know, until Northwest calls my office and I sit down and meet with them and they tell me that this is true, I'm not going to put any weight into it until that happens.
Is it frustrating being a governor and having seemingly so little control over big things like this?
No, not at all. These are private sector businesses. This is not the role of government. The role of government is to handle the infrastructure and govern the people. Our role as government is not to go out and ensure that big businesses are successful. Our role as government is not to go out and be partners with business in the private sector necessarily. That's their job. That's the private sector. That's capitalism in America. And I don't think that our Constitution ever set it out that it was government's role to ensure that someone is successful in business. That's part of entrepreneurship. It's part of, if you want to call it, the great American dream, in a way, that here you can build a dream, excuse me, in the private sector and be successful. I don't think it's necessarily the role of government to ensure that success. Naturally, we're there to be supportive. Naturally, we want a good, solid economy. But again, I think the mainstay of this lands on the shoulders of the private sector. And it's not frustrating to me. It's more heartbreaking. You know, I feel bad for, you know, losing a job. If you've ever lost one, I've lost them. It's not a good feeling, you know, when you walk in and get fired, especially when you know that you're working to the best of your capabilities and the best of your ability. It can be very depressing to have that happen. I've gone through it before. I know what it's like to lose a job, and it's not fun. But the great thing about America is you can pick yourself up by your bootstraps, strap your chin strap on, and go out there and be successful again. Because, you know, I'm a great believer in fate. I think in some ways things happen for reasons, and many times when a negative thing happens, lo and behold, a couple years down the road, that negative can be turned into a positive as an individual.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour, and we have, well, a couple open lines. So if you've got a question for the governor, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's get started with our listener calls. John, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Governor. I just want to remind the governor that they're not mining iron ore up there. They're mining taconite. Taconite, as I understand it, was invented at the University of Minnesota to save the iron mining industry. And so there has been a public-private partnership in Minnesota before, and I think maybe in this instance something like that could happen again. Maybe they can make that or even better taconite.
Well, according to the bosses that I talked to yesterday, they can't. And because of what's coming out of the ground at this particular mine. And I have to take these gentlemen at their word that they know their business. I'm not an expert on it, and I don't claim to be. And it's a case that we will do everything we can. You know, we've got a dislocated worker response team that is in place. They've already talked to the local United Steelworkers and at the workforce center and everything like that, and we'll do everything. But again, it's a private business, and if they so choose to not invest the $700 million that they say it would require to make this work, and if their bottom line is at the end of that investment they're not going to reap a profit that can pay off that investment, why they're not going to do it. And it can be very dangerous for the state to get into subsidizing that way or for making up the difference. You know, it that's a slippery slope you got to be careful of.
Steve, your question, please.
Yes, I was wondering, you're making these suggestions about public subsidy and stuff like this. What don't people understand about this? This is a hole in the ground. You referred to a fishing hole. You can restock a fishing hole, but you can't go in there and restock a mine.
You're right.
Producing a non-marketable material. Now, if they want to expand their efforts and their energy into finding some way to keep this open, let them investigate trying to find a market for what they are producing. But if it's a non-marketable commodity, there's no point. You're just literally pouring money in a hole in the ground.
And I'm not going to argue with that. You know, the company is the experts. They know what they want to get out of it. And again, it's private enterprise.
There have been some questions raised again yesterday with this new civic organization, the Great North Alliance, suggesting that we need the state needs to spend more time and energy focusing on future industries, the things that would help us be more competitive as we move deeper into the information age. What do you see the state's role in that endeavor being?
Well, I think that we had some great initiatives that unfortunately the legislature ignored this year. Hopefully they'll take them up next year. Our telecommunications initiative that Commissioner Min, or former Commissioner Min, and Commissioner Fisher were both spearheading, and unfortunately the legislature decided they wanted to kick Commissioner Min out. They didn't like him for personal reasons or whatever it was, the choice they made, so he's gone, and so I have that on my plate now in the interim is to fill that position. But I think what we can do is technology is the future. And here in the Twin Cities, we're in good shape. You know, technology's in fine shape down here. But our job is to go out and make it competitive throughout all of Minnesota so that businesses can locate in greater Minnesota and have the ability to lock into the technology and have it out there. And I believe that the way you do that is competition. And so our technology initiative makes for competition. And when I say competition, I'm talking about there's no reason that the telephone company can't compete with your cable TV company to provide internet service. Let them all get on board. Let them all be part of the bidding so that it's like the old days when there was just Ma Bell. Well, when you only had one telephone provider, the service you got, you had to take what you got. But if you have more options of two or three providers, then you have choices that can be made, and that makes it for a competitive field where one competitor will try to provide more than another in which to secure your business as an individual. So I think that's one of the things we have to look forward to in Minnesota, is going out and making sure all of Minnesota is up to snuff on this technology age, and that we all have access to it so that businesses can survive and thrive in greater Minnesota.
Now, they're also talking, though, about the need for more funding for the University of Minnesota, presumably some kind of additional educational funding. There was talk yesterday about providing education support for people from pre-kindergarten all the way up through 2 years past high school, more research and development money. Do you see that in the state's future?
Well,
because it seems like all the emphasis has been on reducing state spending.
Yeah, well, that's something that judgments have to be made on. It's not a bad investment, because I know, to me, you want to make focused investments on your infrastructure. That's what government should be doing. And infrastructure can include, absolutely, education. The better educated workforce you have, the better jobs that are out there and are available for people. But again, it's a fine line you have to draw. The money has to ultimately come from the taxpayers. So the taxpayers have to understand that in the end they foot this bill, that if we are going to invest in these type of things, if we are going to take our resources and put them in there, that ultimately it's the taxpayers who pay for that. And is that a good investment? That's what our judgment should be. If the investments are good, then we should invest in it. If we look at, and you have to look long term. You have to look, of course, if you invest in things that are going to make higher paying jobs and keep people out of unemployment, which we now have the lowest unemployment in the United States of America, and we've been voted again. I think people in Minnesota should take a positive look here. We were also voted, I think, for the fourth time now or whatever, the most livable state in the United States. We're doing good. We have to think on a positive level. Yes, there will be setbacks like the mine. Yes, there'll be setbacks out there. There always will be. But we look at it as a positive whole. I think we're doing very well here, and we just need to make the right investments, invest in our infrastructure, not get caught off doing things that is out of the role of government. And if we do that, I think we'll be just fine.
Rachel, your question, please.
Hi, Governor. I have a question about the China trade bill and your views on it. Do you think that the mine is having a problem with their outdated technology and their equipment because U.S. trade regulations have not been enforced in the last few years? And do you think that we're competing against countries that can pay their workers much less and therefore produce a product much cheaper?
I don't necessarily think so. I don't think we're bringing in a lot of Chinese iron right now or Chinese steel into this country. And I view that the global economy is on us. We can't hide ourselves from that fact. We are in a global economy. We are global competitors, and the state of Minnesota is a global competitor. I believe if we were our own country right now, the state of Minnesota, we would be like 28th or 32nd economically in the world. The state of Minnesota. Now, that doesn't count all our other states, but if we have, as the state of Minnesota, were removed and were our own country, we would be, I forget what it is, we're like 28th or 32nd or something like that. And so the global economy is real. And this whole China, I think a lot is being made out of it that is not really true. What China is already sending to us, they will continue to export to us. What this did is it opened up the Chinese markets to our products. It opened up a potential billion people as potential customers for United States products, be it agriculture, be it technology, be it medical. Tremendous amount of opportunity here, opening the doors. And one of the bigger things this is, it's going to lower the tariffs so that we don't have to pay these huge unbelievable tariffs to get our goods and services into China. And when you lower those tariff costs, that in turn means more profitability for our companies. The one that comes to mind right now is I remember meeting with our ag industry people, and they're saying that this opening China could be a boost as high as 50% to our ag industry over the next 10 years. 50%. Think about that for a moment. The one that comes to mind, though, is I met with the head of the Barley Growers Association, the people that grow barley. Right now, they face a 30% tariff on all barley that goes into China. Well, with this agreement, that tariff drops to 10. So you're talking a 20% profit right there on just reducing the tariff on the barley. And I was told that the Chinese people really like beer. They enjoy beer, and that our, well, you know, you laugh about it, but it's, you know, it's the truth. And our barley quality is much better than theirs, and our barley will make a much better beer for beer producers. And imagine that when you increase your the possibility of 1.2 billion customers for your barley industry. I see it as a positive, and I see it as something we had to do because, rest assured, we weren't isolating China. We were isolating ourselves. If we would have voted this down, we would have been the only country in the WTO that wouldn't have had normal trade relations with China. All the others would have, and I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts that the other countries deep inside were hoping we would vote this down. They were hoping to get us out of the picture because that would open the doors up for them, and it would keep us, we would have been isolating ourselves, not isolating China, because China's going to is in the WTO, and they are going to be trading with the, all the other countries. This was a matter, are they going to trade with the United States? And I'm glad that we said yes, they are, because you can talk about the human rights issues also. How are you going to change someone's human rights if you don't have a relationship with them in some manner? By putting up an embargo or putting up a wall against China, then we're not going to have the influence on them that we will have by trading, by our companies doing business with their companies, by showing the Chinese people what the United States workplace is like. You think they're not going to go back to their neighborhoods and talk about it? Sure they are.
George is on the line from St. Cloud with a question. Go ahead, George.
Yeah. First, I'd like to thank the governor for coming on and answering questions. You take a lot of heat, and I think it's great that you come out and answer the questions.
Well, I try to do my best, George. I mean, I don't know it all, but I sure learn quick.
Well, good. My question has to do with, I live out here in the country, out by Annandale area, and all the farmers are planting corn and soybeans again, and then they get the bumper crop, and they get they lose about 10 cents an acre selling their corn and soybeans.
Yep.
And they spend a gazillion dollars to fertilize because they're sucking everything out of the soil. Hemp grows in poor soil. And my wife sows for a living and got some hemp samples from a company out of Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And the fabrics are great.
Phenomenal.
They're very durable. Yep. They're great to work with. It's all natural. And boy, we got all kinds of bad soil farms around, and if that was promoted somehow, and maybe something for those guys up on the range to be sewing together to make products. And
well, George, first thing we have to do is rethink our archaic war on drugs, because that's the problem right now. You have hemp included with marijuana, which in turn is included with all other hardcore drugs, and we have the DEA out there and the huge amounts of money we spend to prohibit these types of plants. And I agree wholeheartedly with you. We are missing the boat. Canada is producing hemp now, and all the products are coming right across our border, and they're making money, and we're not, because we have these archaic laws on the books that somehow everyone thinks that if hemp is allowed to be grown, that we're going to have fields of marijuana all over the state. And what they don't realize, many people are somewhat ignorant, you can smoke 2 tons of hemp, and it's not going to do a thing to you. And the hemp itself will ruin the marijuana. You know, the kind of marijuana that people smoke to get high off of has to be separated and handled differently than the hemp that is grown, or what you call ditch weed. I go hunting, pheasant hunting in Iowa, and you see it growing all along the ditches in Iowa, down there, all over the place. And George is absolutely right. This is an industry, the hemp industry, that we should be exploiting. We should be looking into it. Fabric from hemp is phenomenal. I've had shirts delivered to me. I've had tennis shoes made out of hemp, but, you know, not naturally, not the rubber, but the upper part of the tennis shoe made out of it. And it hemp is a very versatile product. And George is also right that it doesn't require fertile land. This stuff will grow anywhere. As I said, you go along the ditches in Iowa where they don't turn the ground over, they don't fertilize or anything, and you see these things growing 16 feet high, and they'll grow that in 1 year. It's a very renewable resource. It also makes better paper than wood does. And imagine if you have hemp growing 16 feet in a year, how long does a tree take to grow 16 feet? About 16 years to get there. And to me, we're missing the boat drastically, and it's because of this archaic war on drugs that we have out there that takes priority over looking at a viable product like hemp that we should be exploiting. Also, what's terrific about it too, hemp can actually be cut up and used as where many, I know this from the horse business. My wife, she uses wood chips in the stalls. Hemp is actually better for it, cheaper, grow it quicker, more economic, but it isn't allowed to be used because it's hemp. And instead, we have to use wood chips.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour on Midday, and we'll get to some more callers in just a couple of minutes. Ask you, are you still determined to get out on the campaign hustings this fall and oust everybody, all the legislators who have served more than 8 years?
Well, ultimately, I can't oust them.
Well, no, but...
You know, the voters of Minnesota are the ones that make that ultimate decision. But I'm determined to make it an exciting and spirited election this fall. I want to bring electricity and excitement to politics, and I see it as being a little blasé this fall, so I'm going to do my best to get issues out there and get the public involved and try to make it a high voter turnout, because what disturbs me the greatest, Gary, is the fact that you look around our country today and voter turnout seems to be dropping in every state. We in Minnesota, well, the last election, we were the highest in the nation, and we can applaud ourselves for that. We had slightly over 60%. But when you think about that, that's really pathetic. That means 4 out of every 10 Minnesotans choose not to participate in a right that is so precious, the right to vote, the right to determine who will represent you and what your government will be. So I'm going to be very active this fall in trying to get citizen participation, get out there to vote. Get out to vote. And I'm also extremely disturbed that our legislature saw fit to tell the people of Minnesota that they're in charge, that the people aren't, that they felt strong enough that the people were not allowed to choose what their government would be, weren't allowed to get educated on both bicameral system and the unicameral system. Our legislators argued it amongst themselves and basically said, well, we did the arguments, we chose not the bicameral system, and you, the people, really don't have a choice in the matter. And I'm a little outraged over that, because I have great confidence in our Minnesota voters, I have great confidence in the people of Minnesota, and had bicameral one, well, then so be it. But to me, it bothers me when you have a system in place that the very people who support that system don't even have the courage to put it out on the line, put it in front of the people, and let the people be the judges of whether that's the best system or whether an alternative system like unicameral could be a better system.
But it sounded the other day like you were, besides the people who didn't support you on the unicameral, it sounded like you were also just going to target everybody who had spent more than 8 years at the legislature.
Well, I'm going to bring term limits around next year. Next legislative session, we're going to carry a bill on term limits.
Formal constitutional amendment.
Yeah. That will limit you to 8 years, whether it's 4 2-year terms or 2 4-year terms. I don't believe anyone should serve over 8 years. I believe that's just my belief. I believe personally that that's one of the big problems we have in government today, is the fact that we have people making careers out of getting elected. We have people making careers out of climbing that elected ladder. And I don't believe that is what our country was founded upon. I believe our country originally was founded that you go and serve. And when you're done serving your time, that you go back to what you used to do. Today, we have people that for 30 to 35 to 40 years have never even gone in the private sector in many cases. They simply get elected from one to the other to the other. Now, people say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, nothing is truly wrong with it, except that our system is very much pro-incumbent. The incumbent has a distinct advantage to win, and plus it's also the two parties. The two parties are out on a power trip of who can control the far left or the far right, and it's decisions are made based upon elections. Well, we'll give in to this particular thing because we have a person we need to get reelected in that area. So it's important that we'll allow, like on a bonding bill, we'll allow this particular bonding thing to happen so that our incumbent can get reelected. He can go back to his constituents and say, look what I brought home. Even though, like this past year, they passed a bill that said, or passed a law that said all bonding had to have statewide significance. And yet, it's so vague that they can turn anything into statewide significance, apparently. They don't even follow. I tried to stick to that. I tried to say, look, we're not going to bond something unless it truly has a statewide significance. The day of these local projects is over. The day of the state funding local projects, let the locals fund and bond their own projects. Why should state government be the fallback position to everybody that needs to bond or get something done? But see, it's very much used in politics there. If they've got someone that they need reelected, why, that person will get the bonding that they need so they can bring home the pork.
Mm-hmm. You stirred up, speaking of the bonding bill, quite a hornet's nest with the Guthrie veto, and then, of course, the legislature overrode the veto.
Yep.
Any regrets about that?
I mean, not a bit. Not a bit. I support the Guthrie. I'm not anti-theater. I'm not anti-arts. But the point is, where do you draw the line, Gary? Now, government traditionally always supports the operational end. Now we've crossed a new boundary. We're now supporting the capital investment building end. Now, they tried to equate it to the Science Museum. You can't do that because the government owns that building. The building of the Science Museum's Inn is owned by we, the government. The Guthrie was private enterprise, and we're going to build or help build them a building that we have no financial interest in. We get no rewards back from it other than a theater. Well, where do you draw the line then if Dudley Riggs comes in? If Dudley Riggs Theater says, well, hey, we want to move to a new building, we want to invest and get our own building, how do you say no to them? You see, what you have here is a dangerous precedent of picking winners and losers. You have legislature saying, well, yeah, we'll support the Guthrie, but you can. What do they do if the Chanhassen Dinner Theater comes in? They going to say no to them now? How do they do that? How do they determine one theater's viability or worth over another theater's? I don't know. And then you can stretch it even, you say, well, the other argument is, well, they're non-profit. Well, the guy that runs the Guthrie makes twice as much as I do. So it's not non-profit to him, is it? And then let's talk about it as a training ground for Hollywood. How many Hollywood actors found their way to Hollywood through the Guthrie Theater? Quite a few. Now, let's take Friends, for instance. You know, the popular sitcom on TV? Those Hollywood actors just signed for $750,000 an episode. An episode. They do 24 episodes a year. Do your multiplication. How much money are they making? So when you talk about high-paid professional athletes, what about high-paid professional actors? Shouldn't Hollywood be supporting the Guthrie Theater as more of a training ground for people they get later that go out to Tinseltown out there and become huge successes and make huge money? I have a problem with understanding why it's government's role to fund a theater building.
Now you had, and I do want to get some callers here, but now as I understand it, you had found a lot of other items in that big bonding bill, which wasn't as big as it used to be, but still a pretty good sized bill that you were thinking about vetoing and decided not to. Why did you back off from those?
Well, I didn't want to I didn't want to get into a fight with the legislature, and I felt that my main purpose of the bonding bill was to ensure the state got what it needed, state government. And we did good. They were very good to state government, which they should be good to state government. That's what they're there to do, is be good to state government. So I took a more laid-back attitude of, hey, we got what we needed to repair our infrastructure, to do what we needed to have done. I'm not going to be harsh to them. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because I barely vetoed anything, and they were going to, I mean, I think people should be highly disturbed when one of their elected leaders comes out in the newspaper to the media and says, well, we voted for things we didn't even support just to get the governor. Well, how did they get me? And that, of course, was Senator Dick Day, who came out and said that. Well, how did they get me, Gary? They're going to get me by spending the public's money? They're going to get me by somehow they think if they authorize a bunch of pork barrel pork and bring home the bacon, that somehow gets me? That doesn't get me any more than it does you, because you and I will both pay equally to fund it. So they're not getting me, and if they think my ego is into this game, they're crazy. I mean, I'm here to do a job. My job is simple. I'm the CEO of the state of Minnesota, and my problem is that I, instead of a normal CEO who has to deal with one board of directors, well, I have a bicameral board of directors, which you won't see in the private sector at all. You don't see bicameral board of directors. You see unicameral board of directors.
Maybe it takes two bodies to keep you in line.
Not at all. One body could actually do it easier. One could do it easier.
Henry, your question, please.
Well, Governor, I thank you for the work you're doing and the heat you take. And I don't think the politicians do get the message at all. They were saying how we wouldn't vote for your unicameral. They were scared to death to put it on the ballot.
Exactly. It ended up, Henry, self-preservation.
Yeah.
They're not going to jeopardize their positions, their elected positions, and allow the people to downgrade them.
I'm 60 years old, been a Republican all my life. I left the Republican Party to vote for you. I left because I was so disgusted with what was happening in Washington, D.C. And they just don't get it. But locally here, one of the things I wanted to call about was to ask you to push a little bit on those meters getting on the freeway, if we couldn't get those things eliminated. And the other thing I'm calling about is I feel they're beginning to get to a point of violating our rights with these cameras all over the place, watching our every move. They say they can see inside our cars when we light a cigarette or whatever we're doing. And now they're putting a helicopter up there, I understand. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that helicopter.
Well, first of all, helicopter's been up there for a while, because I got a speeding ticket about 8 or 9 years ago, and I got caught by the helicopter. So I don't think helicopters are anything new right now. You know, they've been up there for quite some time, and doing traffic work. As far as the meters go, you know, that's a pro and con decision. I mean, I live up now. My private home, of course, is in Maple Grove, and I have to drive down Weaver Lake, you know, 94, where the Weaver Lake Road exit is quite often. And we used to have just unbelievable traffic jams up there, and then they put the meters in on Weaver Lake Road, and it seems to have alleviated a lot of the traffic jams. The traffic, they're still big, but it flows now. It's not stopped the way it was when it was just a constant flow of merging. So what we need to do is look at the situation, and I'm not opposed to them not announcing and turning the meters off for a month and just to see what would happen. And I think that could prove once and for all that the meters maybe do work. Because, like I said, we didn't have meters on Weaver Lake Road, and it was a mess on 94. It is still heavy traffic in the morning up there. But now that they put the meters on there, the traffic seems to flow better, because it only allows the cars in. It allows them in at a specific rate, rather than all of them just charging down the ramp and forcing a standstill to happen while they all have to merge in.
Traffic related.
That was another interesting thing out of Senator Day, because Senator Day was the spearhead of that. But you know what I find interesting about it, Gary? Is he doesn't have one meter in his district. So who is he representing here? He's down in Owatonna. There's not one ramp meter in his entire district, yet his major focus was on ramp meters. Now, I could understand that if it would have been a Twin City metro area legislator bringing it up, because then he's dealing with his constituents. But maybe we should stick a couple ramp meters down in Owatonna so that then Senator Day has something to base his complaints upon.
It's a traffic-related question. Tragedy, sure. Actually, the Malik Sealy business brings to mind the drunk driving issue.
It also brings to mind another issue. Put your seatbelts on.
There was a bill before the legislature, which, as I understand it, would have required or would have included prison time for fourth-time DWI repeat offenders. Do we need a law like that?
I think so. I think we do, over the fact that people don't seem to want to take drunk driving serious.
Apparently it's going to cost a lot of money, though.
Well, any time public safety is involved, there's a price tag that goes with it. How much do you put on Malik's life? You know, what value do you put on Malik Sealy's life? Snuffed out at age 30, the prime of his career, family, kids, and what price tag do you put on that? And the point being is that, you know, we've got this huge battle for gun control right now. You know, everybody's up in arms on banning firearms and guns and all that thing. Yet, how can anything be more dangerous than someone impaired driving a two-ton vehicle down, like in this case, the wrong way on the highway in the early morning hours and doing speeds of 50 to 60 miles an hour? I mean, to me, that's as dangerous as any gun there is in the world. And you know, if we're going to be as serious on gun control, I think we have to be likewise as serious on drunk driving. I mean, nothing offends me more, Gary, than when you read in the paper how somebody was given their 11th or 12th DWI 11 or 12 times. Well, what that means, Gary, is that they've probably done it 200 to 400 times. These are just the 11 times they've been caught. And when you think about that, and you think about the innocent victims out there who end up, as in this case, why is it always the person that is intoxicated that lives, for whatever reason? It just seems to be that way all the time. And the person that's not is the victim. And so I'm a believer that absolutely, we need to follow Europe on that. That's one of the few places I'll come out and say that Europe sets a real good example on drunk driving. They are intolerant of it. Over there, you do it once or twice, you don't ever drive again. Back here, we've got 11, 12, 14 times people get convicted. It becomes a joke. If you don't put teeth into the law, then don't have the law.
Can't let you go without asking you about the chapter, the new chapter.
Gary, you're going to disappoint me.
Well,
all of these media out here are waiting in bated breath. They've all packed in here to your radio station to try to corner me, and I bragged. I said, you know what? Gary Eichten won't even bring that up because he sticks to issues. He don't worry about personal stuff.
Well, this is kind of an issue.
Go ahead, Gary. Stoop to their level.
Corrupt, shameless, and irresponsible as hell. I guess I would qualify in all three categories. Now, it's great copy, you know.
It's right. It sells books.
But you don't really believe that, do you?
I believe that our media today is not held responsible. And I believe ultimately it's our fault because we don't hold them responsible. They write things today without backing up stories. They write them without getting second or third collaboration or whatever to determine whether the story's real or not. They don't worry about who they hurt as long as they get a headline out of it. And if they can't stand the heat, then they ought to get out of the kitchen. And if the shoe fits, they ought to wear it. And if it doesn't fit for them, well, then they have a clear conscience, don't they? They can say, well, Governor Ventura's meaningless. I don't operate that way. But if the shoe fits, maybe they ought to wear it. And then it's a wake-up call to them, I think, a little bit, that they better do their homework and that they can harm people by things they write about people that may not be true, and they can harm people by the way they write them, by not opinionizing stories that don't have opinions to belong in them. I mean, we understand, like in a newspaper, the opinion page, the editorial page, that's what that's for, is opinions and editorial. But a proper news story should not have a writer's opinion blended into it. And we're getting far too much of that today. Opinion.
Who do you want to play you in the musical? The Jesse Ventura musical.
I'll leave that up to Pierre. Pierre's the expert. Pierre will do the casting. Cosetti, he'll do all of that.
Yeah, but you have somebody in mind, I think, don't you?
Not really, because I don't know who's big and can sing. You know, I guess I'd pick Johnny Lang.
What if they went
But Johnny doesn't quite have the physical presence that I have, you know. I don't know if it would work.
I was going to say, what if they went with some little guy?
Well, I don't think they can because, you know, the story will be of based on the book pretty much. And I'm a big person who wrestled.
Monday Night Football, you're going to do that?
You know, there's another classic example of media blowing something up. You know how that happened? I'm doing Wolf Blitzer talking about China trade. And at the end of the story, he says to me clearly, he goes, my producer here thinks you'd be good on Monday Night Football. Would you consider doing that? And I said, well, they haven't contacted me, but I said, it's probably the greatest you could ever be involved in sports. Certainly if they offered it to me, I probably would be interested and listen. The next thing we know, it's splattered all over the headlines across America with something, again, created by a writer. It was created by a journalist, not me.
I'm out of time. Thank you very much,
Governor. Thank you, Gary. Always good pleasure to be here.
Governor Jesse Ventura.